Hello, you are listening to Montes Press Radio, still live from Etablissement Renfas in Brussels. It's the second day here. It's the almost middle of the second day. We just heard Harmony Grunge, and next up is Melissa Gordon. Melissa is a painter based in Brussels, and she also has a show on in town right now, which is titled Portraits at Portals. At Beige, so check it out if you have not already seen it. But next to being a painter, Melissa is also someone who writes and who has built up an archive, which is called the Living Archive, and this is going to be the topic for the segment today. So a warm welcome to Melissa.
Thank you. This is going to be an oral history of a project that I began in 2005 and have been working on until now, which runs parallel to my artistic practice and has involved about over 200 artists probably since it began. I think the impetus started when I finished the program called Die Ateliers in Amsterdam around that time, and I moved to Berlin. This was in 2005. And it's kind of maybe interesting to think back, or I began when I was preparing this talk, thinking back on the kind of environment in which this began, which was a moment in time in which actually the term feminism was a dirty word. It was something that, especially when I was studying at the Ateliers, was something that felt like a private, perhaps non-aesthetic choice to make. And it's also maybe interesting to think that it wasn't until around that time when the WAC show happened in LA that actually a lot of feminist art at the time was considered embarrassing, perhaps failed. And actually there began to be this moment of making this history actually recontextualized, making it maybe interesting or cool when it wasn't before. So in a way, in kind of thinking back to 2005, 2006, almost 20 years ago, and thinking how, you know, there was actually this sort of existence of the language of feminist discourse. It existed in, you know, critical theory and feminist theory, and there was a lot that was focused on Freud or Lacan or about collectivity, consciousness raising, Marxism, women's rights. But oftentimes what wasn't discussed at the time was questions around subjectivity. And this was like, I bring that up because this was actually like the biggest no-no, and also the biggest thing that was confronted throughout the entire project was that, you know, from the first meeting till now, there's still this question of a gendered subjectivity, which is actually deeply uncomfortable. So I came from a generation of female artists that, you know, kind of began in art school in the late 90s or the early 2000s, that I would say many of us, you know, having kind of spoken to people over the years, felt or aimed to be ungendered, and that the worst thing at the time, you know, you could say was that something was feminism. Or feminine, excuse me, or maybe both. Yeah, but so I remember also kind of as a young female artist, you know, at art school encountering the photographer Francesca Woodman, and then kind of getting to the end of the book and seeing that she had actually killed herself. And it really shocked me at the time, and it kind of embedded this kind of attitude in me throughout, you know, the years to come, which was like, you know, fuck that. Like, that's not actually something to, obviously that's a condition, you know. So again, I studied in the States, then I studied in Amsterdam. And, you know, around this time I was supported by these great female teachers, people like Rita McBride and Marlene Dumas, Jacqueline Humphreys. So I also say that because I feel like the generation of female artists that I belong to, we were supported by these women who actually were sort of the first, you know, in their fields in a way. Not the first, but like the first to be kind of like active, actively participating, and also like very supportive. And a lot of the understanding at the time was like, yeah, things are kind of shit, but, you know, stick together. So in 2008, after sort of having correspondence with some of my teachers and feeling that this was like, you know, an unspoken topic amongst female artists at the time, 2006, 7, 8. Like, you didn't speak about collectivity, you didn't speak about the term feminism, you didn't actually speak about yourself as a gendered subject. I tried to organize a women artists meeting with the writer and art historian Sue Tate, which I can tell more about lately. But we had this idea that we would gather all these women artists, and this actually kind of fell through. We never got funding. It became this sort of like impossible task to get anybody to even want to host this idea of like just a group of women talking to each other seemed so taboo at the time. So actually what happened was I was on a my first teaching gig in Knoxville, Tennessee, and I got a free car and also a free gas card. So I drove to New York, and we were able to take over what was called Dexter Sinister at the time, which was in 2010 in the Lower East Side, which was like a kind of project space and design studio, which was also publishing .. which later became if anybody knows, I'm too tired to remember what they're still publishing it. But at the time, it was like this basement, you know, kind of cool spot run by dudes. And I was like, I'm gonna take you guys over one day, which they were fine with. I invited them, but they kind of just bought me a bunch of donuts and a bag of coffee and left. And in preparation, I went through every single gallery list in New York, and I invited every single female artist I could find or think of. And I think what was really interesting, and I still have records, is of like basically a really positive response. So the meetings, the first meeting, I decided to call it a conversation to know if there's a conversation to be had. And I guess looking back, and I'll talk about this in a bit, I felt like this kind of really nerdy, kind of geeky, maybe desperate sort of character that really wanted to have this conversation. I was like lacking this these relationships in my life. I really did feel like the art world was not the thing I wanted to be in. The places that I went to were kind of not hostile, but like it wasn't always a friendly environment, even though you were, you know. So I think that the desperation in trying to organize this was really about trying to find a community, and knowing that that community actually isn't just always there. It has to be maybe brought together or patched together. So the first meeting happened in April 2010 at Dexter Sinister. There was about maybe 14 people. People came and they went. It was a really great, diverse group of people, and we spoke for about 8 hours. I recorded it. I lost the recording, which I'm very happy, because I don't think it's... Yeah, a lot of things were spoken about that day. And then, you know, I kind of went back to London. I moved to London. I was in the States, moved to London that summer. And then around that time, organized another meeting in Amsterdam at the Kunstverein. And there was about 30 or 40 artists there. And there was also a great discussion. So in those two early discussions, you know, some of the main things that came up were this question of work and labor. And there was a kind of beginning to understand that, like, this idea that, at least at the time in 2010, again, I'm like way back in time here, a lot of what you were asked to do as an artist at the time was essentially women's work. It was care work. Like, you were unpaid. There was no such thing as getting a fee at that time. And so this discussion of like trying to think that actually we could like apply feminist thinking to the concerns of all artists, which became the kind of rallying cry throughout the project, was really highly motivational, and also something that was kind of very eye-opening. Women in Amsterdam talked a lot about like trajectories of careers, but also this notion that, like, you know, as a working subject in the art world, essentially you were highly used, you know, or used to create capital of various forms. So around that summer, again in 2010, I was organizing another meeting in London, which was going to be at Raven Row. In the process of organizing that, I met the writer and critic Marina Vishmit, and I actually looked back through a lot of our correspondence lately and realized that I wrote to her probably in like the late spring of 2010, and within 4 months we had actually published a journal together, which is absolutely mental to think how actually motivated we were, how much time we must have invested in this, and also how much people were willing and excited to contribute things. So Marina and I, and with the designer named Kaiser Lasanaro, we acted as a collective. We spent months sitting together and talking, and we came up with this magazine called Labor, which came out in, I think, oh, actually, I'm wrong. It was 2011. So it's a bit bad, yeah. And maybe I'll read the editorial from that, because it is what we thought. Labor is the first and foremost concern that arose during a series of female artist meetings in New York, Amsterdam, and Berlin throughout 2010 to 11. These meetings, organized under the title A Conversation to Know If There's a Conversation to Be Had, attempted and continued to attempt an operation to create a level and open playing field to ask if there is anything to discuss as a group of women artists, lacking the appeal of any form of art world promotional event or predetermined prerogative of a discussion group or seminar. What became apparent from long periods of talking without a director or a specific question was that not only is there plenty to talk about, but what there is to talk about is not just about gender, but rather systems at work, systems that are in place within the economy of production. A figure emerged of the dislocated subject. When trying to sketch the parameters of a woman working, one realized that the conditions apply to all artistic workers, that the feminization of labor both requires a reading of women's work and at the same time validates the current symptom, which is perpetuating the very precarious situation we art workers are in now. Labor and each subsequent issue of the journal, which will change its title, format, editorial team, and subject, wants to bring... So that was already embedded. We had no interest in making a brand, bring such questions about women to the forefront of a discussion about art. And that really did carry through. The subject of labor is being presented through a number of angles and formats. Writers and artists who are critically investigating the questions of production have been invited because their work addresses the very pertinent problems surrounding the figure of the feminized artist as producer. The intent is not to define or multiply a singular topic, but allowing, as Lizzie Borden describes in her interview, a cacophony of voices. The wage worker, the dandy, the woman who chooses to live alone, the painter with multiple personalities, a sculptor with high anxiety, a post-socialist feminist revolutionary, and a collective who has put one of their members through a plastic Christmas tree wrapper and dumped them on the corner. These are the voices represented to do the job of talking about labor, a motley crew for a messy subject. So included, we had Nina Power writing on women's work, Henry VIII's Wives, a presentation of their work, a collective from Glasgow. Lizette Smits and Meredith Sparks talked about the female dandy. I Don't Sing, I Know I Don't Really Don't Sing, a script by the duo at the time, Rachel Bradley and Jessica Wiesner. A Line Spend, which is work of Emma Hedditch. And then Marina Vishmit, who interviewed the working artists in the greater economy known as Wage, which have been agitating for workers' wages for 15 years. And Avigail Moss on painting, and Lizzie Borden, the filmmaker, on her Born in Flames. So once we published the magazine, Marina and I started organizing a series of events that would be launches for the magazine, but also what we wanted was that actually every launch or every part of the promotion, quote-unquote, would be a... like a new platform for someone to make something. That was always the idea, was that it would be, every iteration was about giving a platform for somebody's voice. It was never, simply celebration. So there was a kind of performance at Kunsthal Oslo. There was something at DOR Gallery here in Berlin. There was a performance at Kunstverein Amsterdam and also in New York around 2011. And I think I'm also going to take time today to give a lot of space to Marina's voice. Marina passed away this April, so I've been thinking a lot about her, a lot about, you know, things that we did together in terms of how we did it, why we did it, how I can remember her, through thinking and looking again at what she did. So I'm going to read a one paragraph from her introduction in Labor from 2010. So, you know, she's like maybe, I don't know, you know, 30 years old when she writes this, which I think is fantastic. For the past however many years, I've been looking into the speculative mode of production, that is, ways of valuing labor which disavow its character as labor. Art is the primary site of investigation, inasmuch as art is supposed to be the opposite of labor, typically behaving more like a luxury commodity in the market or an investment of love in the studio or community. But are these cordons still so sanitary, given the proximity of art and labor via the promulgation of creativity and voluntary effort as the watchword for all kinds of work, while the distinctiveness of wage labor itself starts to blur in a climate of debt-fueled proximity, work, and finance? It could be said that the speculative mode of production is not based on the generalization of creativity, but on the confusion about how and where to extract surplus value. Thus, we observe a generalization of the devalorization rather than of self-valorization as a notionally post-capitalist economic or political trend. This is what links the precarity of the artistic mode of production and the conditions for most other work, as they're both subsumed by financialized regimes of accumulation. It's like still true. It is more a generalization of non-value, of fictitious capital, than some idealized creativity. The only way we can speak about creativity here is that, assigned to the frictionless multiplication of money, the normativity of capital's own growth pattern of self-valorizing value extended to all human life. Wage, which is working artists in the greater economy, make the point that artists are structurally and subjectively reproduced as speculators in the market, since their work is not remunerated with a wage. This gives them a direct interest in the fortunes of capital, which wage workers don't have. In a situation where everyone is supposed to be a speculator, investing in themselves no matter what they do, what are the consequences, not just for the critical status of art in relation to the capitalist whole, but to the status of the labor that happens in art? Does it get closer to the industrialized forms of labor, i.e., more like all kinds of work? Does the turn into services as a mimetic genre since the 1960s, and most visibly in the recent relational aesthetics and, quote, socially engaged practices, also herald a final loss of distinction between artistic labor and non-artistic labor? Or does it mark the subsumption of labor under art as a regime of speculation and abstraction, just as it has been subsumed under finance? Is this the sign of a primitive accumulation of other social practices undertaken by art? Or does art just mediate primitive accumulation happening elsewhere? Which I think is still a really interesting conversation. So after we made Labor, we began working on another magazine titled Persona, because it also was the second main question that came up in a lot of the meetings. And again, what Marina and I and Kaiza wanted to do was we wanted to make something that put maybe the answers of a lot of female artists at the forefront of a lot of the questions for all artists. questions of sort of how much of your this was also kind of around the time a lot of like autofiction was like becoming very popular. So there was a lot of conversation around like how much do you talk about yourself? Who is me? Who is the artist? What is this? Also, sort of relationship to history, like that was a big conversation at the time, and whether or not like you were able to speak, maybe almost even like with or alongside voices from the past that didn't maybe necessarily give you the right to do that. You know, so there was a lot of. So it took about a year and a half. We took a long time doing this, and I remember Marina and I would meet with somebody, and then we would have these long, we would tell them everything else that everyone was doing. And then it would, so all of these texts were really developed collectively, actually. And that's something that I think really was special about making this, was that it was, we were deeply involved and highly supportive, I hope, for all of the submissions. So it included a short piece by the pseudonym Gina Ashcroft, which is a pseudonym that Rita McBride writes under about sex and sculpture and traveling. There's a piece by Isla Lever-Yap, who's now Mason Lever-Yap, which was illustrated by her then partner Lucy Skayer on the Hogarth Press, and this idea of kind of the closed loop of publishing and reception. This was the first draft that Celine Condorelli wrote in conversation with Avery F. Gordon on friendship and the kind of radical potential of friendship. There was also a piece by Jen Liu to Marissa Mertz. We republished a bit of Eau de Cologne, which was a magazine that I believe Monica Spruth put together in the 1980s. Yeah, which kind of stood out as this really random, jewel almost from the 1980s, and we were lucky to get to reproduce that. We also had excerpt from an interview between Sabeth Buchmann and Josephine Pride on desire, called The Desire to Desire is Also a Desire, which is great. Some artwork by Mari Lund, an interview with Chris Krauss by Allison Carr, a new piece written by Carolyn Mounier on Chris Krauss, and then two pieces by Ava Kenny on embarrassment and the aesthetic of feminism, and then a piece that I'll talk about that Marina and I did on dropouts, an interview. Also a writing by Nadia Hepson on the British painter Winifred Knights, and a piece by Daria Martin on embarrassment, and a piece by Sue Tate on questions of, this question of like intergenerational connection in female practices. And then we ended with an excerpt from Joe Freeman from the Tyranny of Structurelessness, which is like one of the best feminist texts ever written. We published The Nature of Elitism, and when I wrote to Joe Freeman, I was like, and she was like, "Do what you want. I don't care. I'm beyond it." Which was kind of an interesting. We were all trying so hard to at the time. How do you say? Make the case for feminism, and she was like, "I'm over it. We did that, but go for it," which I thought was an interesting surprise at the time. And we tried to get to publish Katie Nolan's text, The Meta Language of Evil, but she said no. But we did at least get a no, which is the best thing you can get. So I'll also read the editorial for Persona, because it also maybe reveals a little bit of, the desire, again, to think through these questions that came up in the conversations. Again, like, I'm not an I didn't think of myself or Marina, we didn't think of ourselves as editors in the sense of, what are you going to do over there? You got to, like, fill this void. It was very much more about, like, listening and trying to encourage things to come out that seemed were already in other people's minds. So in a way, I think we felt more like organizers than than like editors. What started with the question, how do artists portray themselves to the world, has throughout the past year and a half in discussion with the women presented in Persona given way to a more nuanced set of investigations. In short, artists and writers navigating their way between interior and exterior fields. A persona is a mirrored self, something that is simultaneously reflects and obscures, and it is the imbued qualities of this reflective shift that many of the writings here touch upon. Persona is the second magazine in a series of periodicals that have evolved in response to the question raised by female artists who took part in a series of meetings entitled A Conversation to Know If There's a Conversation to Be Had. The first magazine, titled Labor, and published in 2011, addressed the question of women's work, using the lens of feminist critique to look at contemporary condition of the artist, one of the more explicit topics in the conversations. A more implicit theme throughout many of the meetings was the topic of self-presentation, performance, and the face at the front of the artwork. Throughout the process of compiling, it became evident that at the heart of the publication are two seemingly unconnected themes of embarrassment and refusal, which in this context, I believe, serve to expand our understanding of the persona of the artist. Let your ride begin through the towering public sculpture, Mae West, on a journey to meet a number of characters, often in reflection of or reflecting on other characters and the radical possibilities of these meetings in friendship, in admiration, in desire, in remembrance, and in candor. I'm going to read an excerpt from a conversation that Marina and I had about dropouts, because, like, again, one thing that I did in looking back, you know, and part of the motivation actually for wanting to do this was about looking back and thinking about what was my relationship with Marina. And the one thing I noticed, I looked through all of our emails and there's like absolutely not a single email with content in it. It's like every single email is like, will I see you at this thing? Yeah, I'll be at that thing. Oh, I'm late. I'll see you there. Good to see you. When are we going to, like, we'll see. And so then I realized that there's this, like, the only thing left of our friendship, or of my memories of her, is actually what we published, what we made together. But I know that behind that is these, like, wells of conversation, and also one thing that she did, and I think what you maybe see a little bit in this interview that I want to bring up that I think is so important to note, is that, you know, I always felt like when I started, I was, you know, asking Marina to go into a conversation that I deeply wanted to have, and sort of I think of her as almost like a cheerleader, in the sense of she always was like, that's a great idea, and then she would have this sort of like completely theoretical, you know, sort of like hardcore backup to exactly what you were thinking about. Like, she never denied an idea. She only, as a person, I think it's really, really interesting and important, and almost like a role model. Like, she's somebody who not only said yes, but actually, like, was willing to go on the ride, was willing to, like, believe you, or believe in someone's desire, believe in somebody's impulse, and then sort of work with it, which was a sort of like very radical to do with somebody who was a critic, rather. Like, I think artists do that a lot, but I think to have a friend or to have a relationship in which you sort of did that for each other is actually what made all this stuff happen. Like, that is actually the place of which things got produced, was not just trust, but also this yes and I'm going to think through that with you. Like, actually thinking with and along someone else's thoughts. So we were talking about dropouts, because I was obsessed with dropouts at the time, and she was like, yeah, that's absolutely a topic that we have to get into. I'll read just an excerpt. It's interesting to consider that what Lee Lozano did and what Katie Nolan did and what Charlotte Penensky did, this is me, are all radically different gestures, even though they are the same action. For me, that is what is so fascinating about the dropout. The angle from which you look at it as a viewer shifts the role of the artist. It's almost a prism through which to view an artist, or a prism that the artist positions around them. So this is Marina. So perhaps what makes it the same action is that all three are staging an exit from the same place. The art world, this hypothetical site, is what lends these different gestures the consistency of an action. But what kind of an action does dropping out constitute? Does the artist leave while remaining an artist? Does the artist stop being an artist, or does the artist just disappear off the radar? If art is an institution, then are the two somehow equivalent rather than alternatives. Exactly, this is me. The editorial for this magazine is on mirrors because I feel that this idea of the thing that obscures and reflects has very much to do with what you show to the world. Your physical presence and how you choose to present yourself is as much something that obscures, reflects, and presents at the same time. Marina, that's the idea of the persona, isn't it? Yes, and I feel that this position becomes very clear or crystallized in the object of the dropout. It at first appears that dropping out is a very cynical act, but now I wonder if it's actually cynical at all. Marina. Yes. See, it's always yes. I am not sure whether it is an act that can be mainly defined by cynicism. What it means for a woman artist to drop out is different anyway from a sort of generic dropping out from the art world as an abstract gesture, though no doubt it is always performed in a very concrete and disparate service circumstances. From the perspective of an art practice, dropping out accentuates the invisibility of the woman artist. It is like a double invisibility, doubled in the performance of that which is anyway the case. I think maybe by cynicism, we mean something more like seeing dropout as a tool that gets deployed when you disappear while remaining within the art world in some manner, i.e. neither by disappearing completely or by appearing somewhere else like Charlotte Bozinenske. But continuing to be present somehow in a way that accentuates your value and mystery. At the same time, it is a refusal to fully articulate your presence, while you are also refusing to explicitly situate your absence. And this is more like the Katie Nolan case. So I think cynicism is maybe a modality that comes into play there, but it would be hard to reduce it to that. So that's just an excerpt from Persona, and also kind of an excerpt that shows this really productive, I think, thinking that happened together. So Persona also, once we published it, we did a number of events, including at Flat Time House. No, that was something later. Sorry, I'm going through the magazine here. At the showroom, we did a reading of the Shulamith Firestone. In Sheffield, we did a presentation. We did a talk with Sue Tayton in Bristol, and we launched it with readings by Ava Kenny and Jen Liu at Printed Matter in New York, with Rita McBride in Dusseldorf, and Jessica Wiesner and Nadia Hebson and Paul Becker did a performance at the Wising Arts Center. And then we also did a performance at the Educational Research Center in Liverpool. And Marina and I did a presentation on dropouts at Bureau Public in Copenhagen. And Carlin Mounier did a reading at Archive Books in Berlin. So again, it was like the distribution of these magazines were equally about people coming together physically, similar, I guess, to how they were made. And also, like, the distribution of the magazines, what I've always loved to hear and mostly see is that they've been basically distributed by people seeing them on each other's, like, coffee tables or, you know, like, they've never been distributed widely. They've only been sort of handed around, perhaps sort of shown up in libraries or given to people hand to hand. And so this kind of very, very intense, maybe actually just 2 years, essentially, of working together, of making these magazines, of doing all these launches, of traveling together and sleeping in the same hotel rooms, which kind of... then came to another moment in which we began organizing a really large two series of events which happened at South London Gallery in 2015 and then at Artist Space in the autumn of 2015. And so it was kind of like our lives were changing. Like, we both had jobs. We were both busy with other things, and Kaisa as well. But we were like determined to actually turn a lot of the editorial physical interaction that we had done in the making of these between each other and between with other artists to like make this a collective experience. And this is something that actually sort of like Marina, as a writer and editor and a critic, was like deeply involved with. She was deeply involved in this notion of collectivity being the basis of all positive, productive moments. And so we worked really hard in order to make this like week-long programs at both places. I was pregnant with twins, which is absolutely nuts, for the first one. And then I had like 3-month-old twins in New York, which was absolutely nuts now that I look back on it. And it involved, I will read the contributors. So in London, it included presentations all day to each other. We took over the sort of top floor of Raven Row, and then we did public presentations at South London Gallery. And it was also, I think, this thing about like community building or trying to get almost like a critical, not critical mass, but a critical gathering. And also to talk about collectivity, because it was titled We, Not I. And to talk about sort of where your practice started and other people's practices maybe overlapped. So included Christine Battersby, who wrote the book Gender and Genius, Sarah DeBont, Ellen C. Feiss, Andrea Frank, Eva Weinmeier, Catherine Grant, Maria Guggenblickler, Rosalie Schweiker, Sitzel Monica Hansen, Fiona Jardine, Eva Kenny, Kaisa Lacenaro, Ghislaine Lung, Daria Martin, Carolyn Munier, Rosalind Nashashibi, Kathy Noble, Andrea Phillips, Nina Power, Irene Revel, Liz Rhodes, who was there, which was amazing, Jenny Richards, Grace Schwint, Lizette Smits, Natasha Subramanian, Corin Sworn, Joanne Tatham, Cara Tolmi, Marina, Jessica Wiesner, Vivian Zerl, and then it was hosted by Anna Gritz, Anthony Hudek, and Alex Sainsbury. The goal originally was to create a collective editorial situation in which we would produce the next magazine in order to dissolve a notion of a single editorial voice. And then the form became expansive, and many of the participants focused on their relationship to collective, whether that's historic or contemporary, imaginary. And then in New York, we had, I will read, a number of day presentations, including Angie Kiefer on Ann Carson and Voice, Nadia Hepstein on Christine Ramberg, Ellen Grieg on Arlene Schloss, Larissa Harris on Mayor Leda Menoukilis. And in the evening, we had four evenings of events. So one was called Finding Words and had included Angie Kiefer and Lynn Tillman. And then the next day was titled Presence and Absence with Ariana Raines, Chris Krauss, me, and Meredith Sparks. A third night was called How to Be a Woman with Dara Birnbaum, Joan Jonas, and it was moderated by Kathy Noble. And the fourth last event was On Value, and Marina hosted that with Sylvia Federici, Melanie Gilligan, Shauna Smith-Cruz, Lise Soskoln, and Wage. And so, you know, things after that, after doing this massive project, it was like that was kind of the end. There, you know, things really went quiet, and we just didn't have time anymore. So it actually jump cut. Like, a few things happened. Like, I ran something called Female Genius Nightclub at Wheels, and I also started a series of magazines titled Conversations between female friends. I did that in around 2018, 19, and 20, including the first one, Conversation Number One, was an interview with Chris Krauss with Natasha Subramanian, and then a piece by Natasha Subramanian. Conversation Number Two was with Dana Monroe, Anna Zakharoff, and Erica Lundstrom. And conversation number three was with Mari London, Alice Channer, and the idea of them was to try to make small sort of pamphlets that like record in history a friendship, but through content, not just a kind of interview. And we launched those a couple times. So then I will jump to the last two things that have happened, in which I sort of, on my own, worked on archiving this entire project in 2020, I believe, or maybe 2021, I can't. So there's now a website called A Living Archive, and on it exists all of the launches, all of the publications, a transcript of one of the meetings that we had in London at the Women Artist Library at Goldsmiths, interviews with many of the women who were involved, testimonials. And so as you can maybe see at this point, I'm kind of interested in an additive approach to all of this, and not really to summarizing it. I'm not interested that it becomes kind of about defining something, but rather actually extends. And so the last thing that happened was at a place in Brussels called Celador, in which Alicia, and I hope I'm pronouncing her last name, I'm going to be deeply embarrassed. I'm going to pronounce it correctly. Melzaka, Alicia Melzaka, is that correct? Who's a great curator based in Brussels, invited us, you know, or like anybody, to host an event at Celador. And what we did was we did a series of talks that some were live, some were broadcast, and we've actually just been uploading those to the website. I mean, maybe it's interesting. Nana, do you want to join at this point since you were there? I mean, in the sense that it's like, you know, I could go into the details of everything that happened, but...
I was there on one of the days when you had invited Mia from Mothers and Daughters to present their work. And I think I was curious how the archive that you're doing actually works, or like how other actors sort of play into like your own activities and what other people do, how that plays together in forming an archive.
Mm.
And because I thought it was really nice that you invited them to present their research, and that sort of like unfolded, like the felt that the event and unfolded in like individual packages or something.
Yeah, no, it's called an archive, but it's not actually, I mean, it's meant to be something that is useful to other people. And actually what was really nice was I wouldn't have thought of doing this. We made the website, and actually it's again like, you know, when we printed this, we kind of just thought like 10 people would read it, you know what I mean? And then I don't know how many people have it, doesn't really matter the numbers, but it's really great when people come to you and tell you. So two of the people, like Alicia and Gloria Hasney from the Kunstverein Munich, both said like, oh, well, this is something that has like been really like the website was something that they, I was like, who even knows about the website? Like, I mean, I didn't even like email anybody about it, you know, so I don't even know how they found it. But I think the whole idea of it was that it was about just making something that could be useful or interesting for other people, but then also activate something. And if that does activate something, then you just immediately add it, you bring it in. It's like, again, that I think is a very sort of like, for me, that's like maybe a very feminist like standpoint, is that it's not like, again, of defining this like boundaries or this definition or that's now done, check, or happy. It's actually about like a constant production, like a constant creation of platforms, maybe, for other people's voices, in as much energy as you can muster at any point. Yeah, does that kind of answer mm-hmm. the question? Yeah.
And Yeah, but how, I mean, in this very example of mothers and daughters, it was like they were researching about very concretely lesbian bars in Brussels, yeah, and the history of, and they were building an archive around,
yes,
that.
So yeah, yeah.
There is the idea of sort of making something accessible and accessible as tools, like not archive. I mean, you seem to resist the word archive.
I think it's like interesting that, I mean, I would love to think that I'm just one little everything I've done is like one little distribution network for, hopefully, in part for mothers and daughters. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. I think that is the deeper interest in it. Because I think archive sounds like something, and it's something we actually spoke a lot about at Celador, which I thought was really interesting. We spoke a lot about this idea that in the kind of construction of practices, again, not just female practices, but that the question of female artists, the kind of thing that might be quite acute for female artists, which is like that you're overlooked, that you're forgotten, that like your work doesn't get collected into, you know, it doesn't get collected clearly. It maybe gets collected in bits and bobs, that entire things are lost. You know, I mean, there was like a lot of like one of the.
What do you mean by you? I mean, as a woman, you don't get collected from whom?
No, I'm saying there was a kind of conversation that generally, as a kind of condition, it's maybe perhaps more acute, you know, historically in female practices, that, you know, you see someone like Alice Neal, whose entire body of work is sitting in her apartment, you know, until practically she dies, and then like 5 years before. Anyway, this is a contemporary moment, maybe, or condition. We don't know if this is going to change, but what we were talking about at Celador, which I thought was really interesting, was that, again, whether that's more acute for female artists or not, it applies to many, many artists, this condition of like the fact that your archive is going to be perhaps a narrative through which people access your work, that no one else is necessarily in charge of that, or there's very little, how do you say, collaborators that will work with you on that, and that this idea that an archive actually becomes maybe part of your practice as an artist, or it becomes part of your thinking about the presentation of your practice, because no one else is really constructing that for you, you know.
But then it seemed to have worked already that the website, which is the container or like the memory for what you've been doing, like activated these other people,
yeah,
in great, the interest to invite you, and I guess so it does work as a memory already, as well as a tool.
Mm. Yeah, in a way to like create new moments or platforms of conversation, which again happen as and when people want and energy is there. You know what I mean? It doesn't have to happen all the time, but I think this idea of organizing and being in each other's space is very important. And that was something that I, when I again looked back at this, or I spoke to Kaiza also, the one thing that Kaiza and I spoke about, because I called her a week or two ago and was like, I have a terrible memory. Do you have a better memory? Like, what were we talking about? What were we doing in these, like, 4 months while we were making this first magazine or whatever? And she was, you know, a lot of the things she said was like, you know, now that she remembers, it was like, it was also a very special, she was saying, like, okay, it was a special moment. It was a moment in which, like, things weren't, people had time to spend with each other. You know, people had time to actually spend talking with each other about each other's interests and each other's work. And it was kind of a reminder that kind of, like, physical, presence is actually a highly productive, yeah, motivational.
Yeah, but I guess then, like, that goes back to the name, Living Archive. Like, how do you sort of prevent something from becoming just archive and like not living anymore if you don't have time anymore, or, you know?
No idea. Yeah. But I think like, yeah, having,
or not to become nostalgic, or but then you seem to also do that by sort of reaching out to other groups, or sort of like providing that as a the website also, or that the discussion around the website functions as a network tool or something?
Yeah, hopefully. And I also have, like, sent it to people have been like, do you know, female artists who have done PhDs? I was like, look at, there's a list of, like, 200 artists on this website. Like, go through it. Check them out, you know. But I think, like, you know, what mothers and daughters and girls like us do is, like, you know, way more active and ambitious, and you know, they you know, they've been doing such an amazing program and body of research, you know what I mean? And then this is something that was maybe more active in 2010 to 2015, but it's also maybe, for me, I think part of the motivation of, like, quote-unquote archiving it or putting it so that it was available was actually kind of a way of looking back at a moment in which, from the moment in which feminism was kind of a, not like a bad word, but it was like a, it was very much a word of a historic moment, you know what I mean? And wasn't highly activated within the contemporary art field. It just wasn't. And then to see that kind of develop through a lot, just the means by which providing, I mean, again, some of these, I mean, I don't say it that often, but some of these magazines were made in reaction to the fact that I just was not seeing publications of the artists whose voices I was interested in seeing, you know, and I was like, I could moan about it, or we could actually just make something, you know, and print 500 copies, and
it was a bit similar how when we started with Montes, with the press, that we had like an art school. It came a bit out of this idea that at the time we were a small group of people, and we were really interested in fiction, and fiction was something that like had nothing to do with art school. That was like your hobby at home, to read a novel.
Yeah, exactly. There were these like boundaries and walls, right?
It was theory.
Like one of the first things that actually, I didn't say this in the thing, but it was interesting. Every single woman in all the first meetings said, I'm a feminist and I'm an artist and I'm a woman, but I'm not a feminist artist. That was like the main, and I was like, you know, that was a interesting. Yeah, but these boundaries, right? Like so existed, like I'm an artist, fiction's over there, you know, politics or, you know, whatever, over there, yeah.
Yeah, totally, and, like, I feel it, yeah, it's very strong to then, I mean, just claim that, yeah, instead of moaning, like, just, like, oh, like, it's very DIY, but we're inventing something here.
Yeah, which is the only way to do it. should I end with an email from Marina?
Sounds great.
Because I think it's also one thing I want to point out, or one thing I want to end with, and I always felt like the kind of workaholic or killjoy around, no, but it wasn't true, was that I think that like a lot of this was based on having a lot of fun together, and here's one exchange. So Marina says, "Hey both, this is to me and Kaiser. This is in 2011 when we published it. I think the way you've elucidated the journal's conditions with relation to identification or lack of in the editorial does obviate the need for a title. I guess what still seems like an interesting point is how we talk about it, not giving it a title, not doing that, or skirting the issue, or reconnecting it back to who's the initiator when obviously it's a group process, which has been you instigated. So no titles, unless they're Motley Crue songs. How about the first and foremost album, Too Fast for Love, Theater of Pain? Smoke it in the boys' room, ex Marina."